Welcome to Nonconventional, where we interview unconventional people or people with unconventional careers. Today, I have two good friends of mine with me, Dr. Rani and Dr. Suraj. They are well-being coaches and psychiatrists, and they offer a drug-free path to nurture the mind, body, and the spirit. And they heavily focus on educating people so that they can make informed decisions about their mental well-being. Welcome, Rani. Welcome, Suraj.
Oh, thank you so much, Ella. Lovely to be here.
Thank you so much. And we're very delighted to be here with you today.
So, okay, here's a question for both of you. I went through an extensive research about your work. It's so long that I didn't know how to summarize. Can you please give us a kind of brief introduction about how you ended up in your journey, like first of all, psychiatry, and then how you ended up creating concepts like innate mental health?
Okay, I'll try to shorten it. I think Suraj's journey is similar to mine, so I'll try to summarize and then Suraj can chip in.
All yeah, right? That's fine.
So I guess from my side, it's like psychiatry is not something many people are interested in when you're looking at a post-graduation, specialty, subspecialty or specialty. And I remember I just wanted to find a branch in medicine where you can spend more time with people and then you can connect to people. So that was my initial idea as to why I wanted to work in psychiatry. I just wanted to connect with people and talk to people, thinking that way I can transform people's lives. Obviously, once I joined psychiatry, I realized that just talking to people and just doing what you're supposed to do, which is prescribing medication or referring to talk therapy, is not enough. But that's a whole journey in itself, and the reason I think I also chose psychiatry was I realized that it's to do with psychology of the mind. And for a long time, I've been very, what I would say, lacking in self-confidence as a young child and even as a teenager and growing up adult. I always had low self-confidence. And I guess I wanted to know myself better. And so when we both came to the UK many years ago now, I think Suraj tells the story very well, but we were exploring personal development, how can we improve ourselves as a human being kind of thing. And then I think that journey, I think Suraj can chip into that one, but that started me on wanting to train as a life coach. And then I wanted to collect more and more tools in my toolkit because I was not satisfied. I tried something. I said, this is really amazing because this is not only going to help me and it's also going to help my patients. But then after some time that stopped working, so I would go for the next tool and they say, yeah, now this is really going to help me, so it helped my patients. So it seemed like there was something always missing. So I had to keep doing courses, keep going to all kinds of different tools and techniques and strategies. And finally, then we came across what we call innate health. And then it's like a journey came to a halt, and we realized that this is what we have been looking for, so to speak. So what would you say, Suraj? Does it summarize the journey?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. I mean, my first interest in the subject, I suppose, came when, you remember after we did our academic training in medical school, you have to do your what's called a pre-registration house officer training here, or internship in our days actually. So during the time, we had an opportunity to have a small placement in psychiatry, and I really enjoyed that because we were blessed to have some really good teachers at that point where we trained back in Assam in India. And that sparked my interest. And then I read more about the subject itself, and I was, as a character, I suppose, growing up, I was quite a shy, sort of introverted kind of guy. So I was all up for a subject where I didn't have to do much of the talking. I can just sit back and listen to other people kind of telling me their stories. And so I went, wow, that's a beautiful, specialty to be involved in, and where you are taken on a journey and you are given this privilege of stepping into somebody's view of the world and into their lives and into their past, into their experiences, and working out solutions together with them. And that was my, you know, fantasy at the time before I got into the subject, if you like. And that drew me. And there was some famous books as well, like reading Eric Segal's, you know, I think the book was called Doctors or something. And it was quite an inspiring tale of, you know, a few young doctors kind of together going through medical school in the US, and one of them becomes a psychiatrist. And I really identified with that character very much. That's not, and it was the sort of glamour and the glitz of, you know, being able to do something like that. So I think those were the sort of early days when that seed of psychiatry was kind of sown in my mind. And I came to the UK wanting to be a surgeon, and I did some initial posts in surgery here and there just to kind of test out the waters, if you like. And then I decided at some point, no, the lifestyle of a surgeon wasn't for me. So it wasn't going to be the routine of being stuck in a hospital setting from morning till, you know, nightfall wasn't for me. I needed fresh air. I needed to be out and about. I needed to do something where I can meet real people and talk to people and not just, you know, be operating and not talking to anyone and doing all that stuff. So so I decided, you know, so it was quite a big kind of switch from wanting to be a surgeon all the time to then actually going back to that, to nurture that kind of seed that was sown back along in my mind and in my heart at some point. Yeah, so that's how I got into it. And Rani also, she made the independent choice of picking up psychiatry in her postgraduate training as well. And once she joined me here, we went through training pretty much in tandem, really, in the same.
I made mine before you, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think you went into post-graduation psychiatry before, didn't you?
Yeah.
But I wasn't influenced by that. Yeah. So,
I mean.
But that's how we got into it.
One question to Rani. Why did you choose psychiatry instead of psychology? Because it sounded like your interest was more like the psychology, how we work.
All right. I was already in medical school. You know, if you want to be a psychologist, you don't have to go to a medical school. So I was already in medical school and I was exploring other options. And then I got interested in the psychology of the mind.
So, I think just to clarify, once you go through medical school, the streams that are open to you in terms of leveling up your medical experience is moving on to branches like psychiatry. So if you wanted to go into mental health, so psychology would have been a completely different stream. So it would have been a non-medical stream. So which would have been a radical shift from where we were. So we wanted to remain in medicine, do medicine, and psychiatry, of course, integrates a lot of psychology as well.
And looking back, if you were given a second chance, would you still choose psychiatry or would you change the path and choose psychology?
I was just telling that exactly that thing to someone else, and I think I'm glad I chose psychiatry. So, you know, I don't think I needed to be a psychologist. I'm glad because where I'm at the moment is, you know, understanding the psychology of the mind, but also being able to prescribe medication judiciously, but also de-prescribe medication, which I never would have had opportunity to do if I was only a psychologist, unless I had further training to be a prescriber.
Yeah.
Because that's open nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very, very good question, thought-provoking one, actually, whether, I'd probably say the same. I think looking back, I'm glad for all the experiences we've had and for how life's happened, I suppose, through ups and downs and through lots of positives and negatives with our own experience of doing psychiatry, of course. But that's how it is with anything. Things in career and professional choices don't come in a straight line always. But the insights we've had, it's everything sort of helping us at this moment for us to do what we do at the moment.
Can I just add something else? Just to say that at one point I was seriously considering leaving psychiatry. I let me put that in as well. I was so disillusioned by the field and the limitations that I thought I was just going to leave psychiatry and just be a well-being coach. And in a way, I'm glad I didn't do it because I think the field also needs people like Suraj and myself and many more who can also say this is something's not right here, something's missing, and why don't we help educate people? Why don't we help shift things? And I'm glad we are still around.
What were the exact reasons that made you consider leaving psychiatry?
Okay, let me see how honest I can be. I guess the main thing was that I really struggled with the medical model and how things are meant to be. It seems like very narrow-minded, and this is what it is. This is what the evidence base says. We need to use medication. We need to use this specific therapies, and these are the social interventions. And it seems like you need to put people in boxes, which you can't. You know, how can you just say someone, this is what someone's diagnosis is, and that they would fit in really nicely, and then you give those interventions. We have done that, obviously, as part of NHS, but I will have to say that I have seen people get better, especially if they have been in a crisis and been in hospital and they get better compared to how when they first arrived. But I've also not seen people have transformation. You know, when you go to, say, for example, a life coach, or you're doing something and they talk about transformation, like person's life has changed, they're living a much meaningful life, they're happier and everything's working. I don't see that, and I didn't see that. And so we have to be honest rather than say, well, we see that. We have to be honest. No, why is that missing? What's going on here? So I guess also because there were limitations as to what we could bring in. But obviously now we have found a way around it. And I think there's always a way around, which I didn't realize at the time when I wanted to leave psychiatry.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I'm glad you stuck around because there's a huge transformation happening, I think, in your field. And it's really, I really appreciate having people, doctors around, like you around, contributing to that transformation in the right direction. And the reason why I insisted on, like, why not psychology, why psychiatry, is actually there's a question within the question. Because I've known you both, I think, believe it or not, 15 years now it's been, or 17 even, I'm not sure, I was trying to track, but it's hard. And I mean, you've both always, since the first day we met, like, being an inspiration to me. Like, you're the most stable, wise, calm, peaceful people I know, really. But then when I think about psychiatry, it has a very questionable history as a part of medicine, from I speak lobotomy to insulin shock or, therapies or electroshock therapies and many other sterilization of, mental defectives. And there were so many questionable things. And I just wanted to ask if that scared you at some point, or if you saw that as a challenge, like, okay, this was wrong, but I'm going to contribute to making this right again.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there are things within the subject of psychiatry that we don't like, and which we have kind of drawn our own red lines, if you like, and we say, okay, we are not going to accept everything that's on the menu in psychiatry.
Well put. My question from there is, what were your personal journeys like that led you go beyond the textbooks and search for alternative ways of treating patients?
I think for me, because I was training to be a coach and I had all these coaching experiences, then I realized that There's a lot out there holistic that I don't get to see in the mainstream mental health. And that saddened me. Like, you know, all these things out there, people are doing all this. And if you recommend it within the main setting, they will say, oh, well, there's no evidence base for this, so we can't do this. And whereas, you know, it just felt wrong to say we are not going to do this because there's no double-blind randomized control trials in this ones, because it's like what works for people. And so this is why, and I didn't see it as any different. I was training to be a psychiatrist, and at the same time, I would go to well-being conferences and I would learn techniques. And so that was happening parallelly. So I didn't see it anything different. And I think a lot seeped into my practice anyway that way. So when I finally came across the Init Health understanding, and I had a big aha moment, something that really shook me, and I realized, wow, I was always looking at fixing my patients. I thought they were broken, and I never had that kind of insight before. So that also seeped into my practice slowly but surely. That's how I would explain it. What about you, Suraj?
Yeah, that's a good. I think looking back, as we were beginning our training in psychiatry, we were also looking at self-development, life coaching, and all of those things to improve ourselves at that point. I mean, this is like going back about 15, 20 years now. And it's some of those experiences are like, yeah, those are so transforming and so powerful. You can't but bring those and share those with other people. So, you know, we started, that started influencing our work, that started influencing our outlook and perspectives. So when we were, certainly for me, and when I was dealing with my patients, and I would often, you know, bring elements of NLP or elements of something I had heard, read somewhere in self-development books, or heard somebody in talk about in a self-development course, and you know, those things began to seep in. I said, well, these are important. These are as important as me saying, okay, you take this prescription for that many days and I'll see you again. But in the meantime also, you know, this is how you can understand your thinking or understand your experience a little bit better. I mean, this may be what's going on. And so I was kind of, we were both doing that. And we thought, that was, you know, the right thing to do, and because we felt we were benefiting from those things in our life, we should be sharing those with our patients and clients as well. And you know, one thing led to another, of course, and then you know, the balance tilted a bit towards more going into more kind of holistic ways of understanding well-being and looking at the whole world of mental health. Because there was so much we got inspired by, and we felt we were benefiting from those, and at the same time you see the limitations within psychiatry of, okay, this is as far as you can go by adopting a very medical model of emotional health problems. You say, okay, psychiatry explains things to a certain extent, but beyond a certain point, you say, okay, I've tried everything. I've given you drug treatments, you've done your CBT, CAT, whatever psychotherapy it may be, and then you have so many patients who would be still be desperately in need of help, need of guidance. And that can be quite difficult for professionals, for psychologists, in any healthcare profession who's in the helping profession, of course. And when you feel that, like, you've exhausted your tool bag, but you haven't really changed anything in that patient's life. There was no transformation. They still are knocking on your door and all the time asking for help. And you feel pretty pretty hopeless as a professional. And you've trained so much to be in that place, to be able to help and to call yourself a professional helper. So I think there was that desperation, that level of frustration as well, which I think drove us to seek all those kind of answers that we felt were out there, but we weren't conscious of those at that point. We didn't know what we didn't know for a long, long time. And when we saw some light from, you know, all these different things of, you know, holistic mental health and lifestyle medicine. If you talk about, okay, why eating well is important, why we are a good normal, good sleep-wake rhythm is important in your life, and why activity is important, so how the body and the mind are connected. So we have to bring it to our practice. That's how it all seeped in.
Yeah, right. All these little things that we hear all the time about diet and sleep and, you know, that somehow add up to something magical. They seem very small, as if they wouldn't like create a big transformation, but they can collaboratively all together change something major.
Yes, and there's a branch of medicine called lifestyle medicine now. So it's not even made up. So there's enough evidence that all the things you just said, you know, mindfulness, mindful activities, eating well, like eating well and real food, exercise and movement, sleep, connection, reducing intake of addictive substances, they all definitely help. Not just mental health, but also physical health. So, you know, really interesting when, if as a psychiatrist, you do not take all this history, like how's their day like, you know, what time do they go to bed at night, for example, how long have they been on a screen, you know, doing screen time, what do they eat and how much exercise movement they have, then you will be thinking, oh, this person is depressed, I need to give an antidepressant. Mm. So I think it's so important to look holistic and really look at, is there something else that needs to happen before I even take out my prescription pad? And again, I'm sure we'll talk about that, because that's one of my passion at the moment, is like making sure people have informed consent about any medications that they are being prescribed. And I'm especially interested in the antidepressant overprescribing that we see on a regular basis.
So before we jump into that, Ronnie, you said something very important. I want to go back to that briefly. You said that, like, you don't see your patients as broken. You don't see them as someone who needs fixing. What if they see themselves like that? How do you deal with that?
Yeah. Oh, this is such a great question, because, yes, you're right. People see like that. People say, no, I know I'm broken. And then when you say, okay, just tell me why you think you're broken. And then they'll talk about the trauma, you know, and horrendous trauma. You know, mm-hmm. some bits are unimaginable. And they might talk about their family history. They might talk about their current situation and everything. And I think what people are mistaking is that they think that who they truly are is this, you know, this person, this human that all the stuff happened to. So you're not looking beyond just the human, the body, the human mind, the past trauma. And I think it's very important to acknowledge people where they are. So, you know, trauma, people live the trauma even like 20 years, 30 years, 50 years after it happened, as if it happened yesterday. And I know that it's like, I guess what I'll say to you, to that question is, people, if you don't even tell them, or if they don't even know the possibility that actually I'm seeing it this way, that I think I'm broken, but maybe I'm not, if they don't even know that, and everyone has told them that, no, you're broken, including the professionals, if they say that, you know, you are broken, they will believe it, and they will say, this is who I am. So I guess some people might not hear it, but if the time is right for them and they are willing to have an open conversation and you're pointing them to inwards, they might then hear something, because you are pointing to that. But that helps us as well, as Suraj and myself, when we know clearly that at the fundamental level, their true essence can't be broken. You know, it's impossible. So when we see that, it just helps us, and, you know, do what we can for the person in that moment, even if they're not ready to have that kind of conversation.
Yeah, I was going to say, give the analogy of, you know, there's when we look at the moon, we only see one side of the moon. There's always that other side of the moon that no one has seen from us, right? But if you always were conditioned to believe that the moon is flat, then you think there's no, you know, I'm seeing the whole thing of the moon, and there's no other side. And our job is to actually get people to look at entertain the possibility that the moon is actually spherical, it's round. Then you realize, there must be an other side as well. And people realize that, you know, who they have always thought themselves to be is not the full story. There's something bigger and deeper. And then that lights a spark. That lights the spark that you need to, you know, explore deeper. And I think experiences are real for the person. And when the person, for us as a body, as a person, as a me, that individual me, and my experiences are real to me. And there's no discounting that. And my memories are real to me. And some of those give me joy, you know, all those memories. And some still cause me some sort of grief and trauma if I remember, recall those memories. And that's true for every human being. But the real change comes when we see when we understand there's a kind of deeper dimension to all of this experience. And that dimension is not separate from you and me. That dimension is, that's all going on. But it's been obscured from view for a while because of our conditioning, because of what we have been led to believe. Our own concepts and ideas about, really distorted concepts and ideas about life and reality itself. So I think that's the core of our work now, is to lead people at least to that point when they can actually get a glimpse, and then they're really, really good to carry on the journey themselves with some guidance and get and have their own experience of, from their own self-inquiry.
But that dimension you mentioned, Suraj, and that discovery of the hidden side of the moon is a big journey, even without big traumas, even if you're not dealing with big trauma. And I can't imagine, it must be a major journey, like if you are dealing with trauma and if you are on medication already. So when such patients come to you, how do you guide them out of medication and into that discovery state of the hidden phase of the moon? What's the process like?
I'll share two stories or two ways. And I guess the non-drug pathway is mostly what we do in our inner business. This is what we're doing, the training and so on. But I also work in a very traditional paradigm where people are on medications. Sometimes what we call polypharmacy, they're on so many medications that you wouldn't know what is doing what and what side effects are what. Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, seen people who are very, very stuck in the past or stuck with the trauma and everything. And they have had multiple therapies, for example. So I guess, you know, it's not about like if someone were to come and see me in that setting that I'm just going to take them off medication. You know, there has to be a planning. It has to be right for them. It has to be risk-free. And unfortunately, the prescribing is not so straightforward, especially if someone has been on medication for such a long time and they are multiple medication. It needs a whole team approach. I mean, we don't have any deprescribing clinic at the moment anywhere in the world, but I think that's where we are heading. I'm really hopeful that given the current evidence and given some lobbying from not just patients, but also professionals and even politicians are getting involved. So hopefully we will get the prescribing clinics where we can deal with that aspect and we can also look at the trauma and everything. I guess in a private practice, it's a bit simpler because we have got people who are maybe on one medication or two or three, but they are very, very committed and they are very willing. They know that it's going to be a difficult journey. They know that this happening, but they're really committed, they're motivated. And then again, you know, we'll be looking with them, but there's no set way of doing things. You know, someone might find, you know, that conversations about innate health really sort of it just makes sense to them. They just click immediately and you know, they resonate. And then if that's the case, and they have dealt with the trauma, I was saying, and they have already been looking after their life, you know, lifestyle, and they're really going well, then the next step would be, okay, they want to come off the medication, great. We do that step by step. But someone else might, for example, in my main job, they might come, they might want to come off medication, but equally they are struggling with trauma on a regular basis. It might not be the right approach for them. They might have to be more at ease, more at peace, and come to terms with the trauma, deal with that before they can even say, I want to, reduce medication, because they can reduce the medication. But the challenge is that if the original problem is already there, how they view things, they are still being fearful of the past, and the medication was prescribed for that in the first place, it might not work so well. So I guess that's how I would say it. What about you?
Yeah, people are in different stages of their journeys to realizing what they need to realize about themselves and their experiences. So you have to meet them where they are. So, and as Rani was saying, we see people in different stages along that path. So in private practice and in government practice, they'll be completely in a different place. Many of them, not saying all of them. So, and that's not normal. I mean, that's the way life goes for us. And it's about not imposing what we think may be right for them. It's meeting them where they are and letting things unravel or unfold for them in their own time. So I think that's really important. And for us as professionals to create that space of hope and possibility for them and not give up on them, I think that's the biggest thing one can offer as a healthcare professional thing. And not to give up on people, because they may seem, okay, they're so stubborn or resistant to change, or it's so easy sometimes to take that stance and say, okay, well, they're not, never going to get that, they're not up for it. But it's because of many different factors, because of how real the experience has been to them. And we have to acknowledge that. So meeting them where they are and as a therapist, as a professional, us to remain grounded in that understanding still, because that will allow us to create that nourishing space of hope and possibility for them. And when the time is right and ready for them, and they will make that single step forward and the next step. And that is so important for them, for us to allow them to do, and pull them along ourselves, but to let them take those steps themselves.
I have a quick story about a patient I remember who is in a work setting, in a normal work setting. She came to my clinic and she had multiple trauma. She had been on multiple medications. She had multiple therapy, and she was wondering whether she should go for more therapy. I was trying to share with her about the innate health understanding in my clinics. And she nodded her head and said, yeah, but can we look at medication? But can we increase the medication? Can we do this? At least we had a rapport. She kept coming back and she realized what I was saying about medications, they can only have so much effect and so on. So anyway, I invited her to a course I was doing, I think it was a 6-week course on innate health that I was doing as part of my NHS work. And I was doing it with someone else. So she came to that for the 6 weeks. It was only like for 3 hours a week or so. But her feedback towards the end of the 6 weeks was that, everything that you were sharing with me in your clinic now is starting to make sense. Mm. And it's like it needed some time for it to sink through. And it was fascinating. And she said, I realized I don't need more. I was thinking I don't need more medication. I need more therapy. And she also had a huge life event while that she was going through our course. And she said how she was able to deal with that was very, very different to how she would have dealt with that before having this understanding. So I thought, oh my goodness, thank goodness it was not time wasted. I might have thought, oh, there's nothing, so I'll just give her up. And but it took time. It just took time. And then she saw something for herself.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. So, Ronnie, where is this innate health idea coming from? Like, why do you assume that we have this innate health? And you even said, I think, that our essence is unbreakable. Like, where is this belief coming from? What's this based on?
So obviously, that's only a metaphor. Innate health, what is innate health? That's just a metaphor. People are just using the terms, and other people might use different terms. But we first got introduced to what we call the three principles understanding, and that's what is called innate health, where I had my aha moment. But actually, some people would say that's a cult, or what is this three principles understanding? But many spiritual teachers have been pointing to that anyway, whether you call it three principles or you call it something else. And many, many spiritual teachers are pointing towards non-duality. If you just think of many names, they are all pointing in the same direction. And I guess what's happening in mental health is we are saying mind and body, but we are not bringing in the spirit aspect. And so mind, body, and spirit. But the more you think about it, there's more to us, human beings. We say human beings, but we are focusing constantly on just being human. And we think we need to do something for the being aspect. But being is already there. Presence is already there. And we don't have to do anything to be. And the more we share with people and say that, okay, we have been focusing enough of the human dimension. What can I do for my mental health? What should I practice for my mental health? What medicine should I take, and what therapy I should go for? What's the being aspect of being human? And in people who are listening to this, they might think, oh, I'm not spiritual, I'm an atheist. But is that whether that's a belief? I can say, well, I don't believe in God. We definitely are not religious at all. That was not part of our upbringing. But we always felt that there was something more to life than just us. We always felt there was something bigger. And it's very difficult to articulate and say, this is exactly it is, what it is. But the more, I think this is where I would say that it has definitely helped me to go beyond the brain and the personal mind to what is beyond us, what already is. And that's what we mean by, the innate health and our true essence. But I know Suraj has a very lovely way of explaining, much better than me.
You put me on the spot.
That's the intention.
Yeah. It's something you can try. A lot of people have tried, gurus have tried, spiritual teachers have tried to define what it is. And it will always come short. Words cannot define something that is completely shapeless. Because there's no form to describe it, that it looks this, it is this, it looks that way, or it is of that shape, because it is this limitless, infinite space where everything resides, where everything is. And as Rani was saying, that's the beingness of our existence, of everything.
And how does that translate to health?
Yes. Oh, good question. I was going to say that. So we are in mental health care. We talk about the fact why if we try to answer the question, why do we suffer psychologically? Why do we suffer psychologically? Why do we have emotional suffering? Then the next question is actually, who is it that is suffering those emotions or that kind of the psychological problems? And the answer would be, I'm suffering. I'm suffering. And who is that I? And who is that I in that sense? And it comes down to that sense of identity, that sense of, what is my identity? And is my identity me as X, Y, Z name and this title and this in this residing in this body, residing in this mind? And when I say mind, I should point to the gut as well. The gut is a mind as well. And or is there something deeper? So, and for a lot of us, for the best part of our lives, we are caught up in this sense of this is who I am, and this is where it starts, this is where it ends, and once that goes, I'm in over the end, and once the body goes, there's no sense of me at all. And that, if you've got that sort of limited sense of who you are, and I have no problems in saying that's a limited sense of your identity, because, and that's the identity that this person takes, this ego takes, as it takes a life form and as it goes through life and is conditioned to believe things and conditioned to believe in certain concepts and ideas about experiences and the world and so on. So it comes down to that sense of identity. When you are so invested in this personal identity, and that will lead to psychological suffering. That will lead to this cycle of suffering all the time, and it'll be very difficult to get out of that cycle of suffering. And the breakthrough really comes when you get that insight that there's something deeper. There's another dimension to all of this. Where is this personhood, this dance of the personhood happening? Where is this being acted out, this life form happening? What is the stage, if you want? And we understand that the stage, we call it consciousness. Again, you know, you can use words and phrases, but nothing comes close to describing what it is, right? So everything is happening within that space. And if you look at it, you know, everything has been acted out. And we as individuals are one of those actors in this big play that's going on in life. And when you see that there is a, you can appreciate that there is a deeper dimension, there's a bigger space where all this is happening. And that's the true space of, that's the feel of well-being and love and well-being and health. Because that's where everything starts from, and that's where it goes back to. And some people would call that, you know, that's God, that's the supreme force or whatever it is. And the biggest illusion in life is to think that you are separate from that. And when Rani was talking about non-duality, and the illusion is we think we are separate from that. And the truth is we are not separate from that. It is all, everything is in unity. We are one. And the suffering is also part of that. And the bad things are also part of that. Because they are not happening in any other space. Right? And when we get when people see that, there's a big light bulb that goes on. That's not the intellectual light bulb, that's something very deeper. And you get this warmth from a deep place, and something blossoms within you, and that awareness blossoms. And I think, and that's the powerful, that's the transformation. Mm. And that's the what we call the healing from within, because there's no need. The healing is there. The health is always there. It's the well-being is always there. So it's really living a life as a human being, not human doing. What we mostly tend to do is, you know, we feel like for wellness, well-being, fitness and health, you have to do so many things as human beings. But when we need to sit, we need to align ourselves more with that sort of being aspect of our existence. And the beingness is to realize that realize the non-duality of our existence with that bigger dimension, that deeper dimension. And that's it. You know, it's very difficult to describe in words.
Yeah. I can see how what you're describing can transform someone who's already in a safe situation, who may be dealing with past trauma, but now is out of that trauma and is open and strong enough to look back at it and in a way, heal it or become aware of that the essence is intact anyway. But have you had experiences with patients who are still in maybe dangerous situations, abusive situations, difficult environmental situations, and that they could come out of those situations and heal to this degree?
Not personal experience, but there are lots of, we have had lots of people, professionals or coaches, innate health coaches, who have shared that how they themselves were in that place. Maybe they were in the midst of domestic violence and they couldn't even leave the violent relationship because they were worried about what would happen in their life if they left, suddenly hearing something for themselves in the midst of it. So yes, so it's not like they have to deal with the trauma first and then you're ready. It's like the readiness can happen anytime, as long as you are being pointed in this direction. The other thing is my mentor, Dr. Bill Pettit, also used to share a story about how he and other psychologists, I think, who share about the innate health understanding, went to a state hospital in the US to just share with the inpatients there. And they were like doing a 6 weeks or 8 weeks program. I don't know how long it was, but they were always would turn up and they would talk to a group. And there was one person who would always come and not say anything at all. And I think they had a very serious diagnosis of schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. And then and in the midst of one of the sessions where they were talking about the innate health understanding, this person just burst out laughing, but he wouldn't stop. He would laugh and laugh and laugh. And he was like, everyone had to stop and say, what's happening to this guy? Why is he laughing? And what's going on? And he just couldn't stop laughing. And then Dr. Pettit said, I can't remember his name, I'll just say John. John, you okay, John? What's happening? What do you find funny? And he just kept laughing. After a few, however long it was, 10 minutes or so, he stopped laughing and he is wiping the tears from his eyes and say, oh my goodness, I just saw that I was the one making myself crazy all these years with my thoughts. And that just happened to him. So Dr. Bill Pettit was not even just counseling him and saying, you are making yourself, sick, you're suffering because of the stories you had with your thoughts, none of that. But he had something very profound because of where people were having those conversations. And, I think that's a very, very positive story after that. So this kind of, awakenings have happened, like when we say insight or a sight from within. So, you and I and Suraj and, we can just keep giving people advice, but, it might just be going through 1 year and coming back outside until that they just see something for themselves. And most people say then, that kind of shift awakening happened, that root awakening might happen when, say, for example, they had a road traffic accident or they were on the verge of dying and suddenly they see something. That's nothing to do with, sharing about, a coaching or anything, but there's a deeper realization that, although they might have gone through their life thinking, I'm just this person who is, 40 plus years old, and I'm from this background, these are my, roles, and these are my stuff that happened to me. And we could carry all those things. This is my identity until something shakes up and saying, whoa, I'm so much more than that. And you said, how is this going to help in health? So imagine someone who has been traumatized their whole life and have been given all kinds of label. They had therapy, they had drugs, they had everything, and nothing seems to work. They can't really see any hope for their life. And if they didn't realize that who they are is not just that identity or that stuff that happened to them, they're much more beyond that. They will say, that's it, my life is over. And so we see this as very, very hopeful for mental health when people wake up to this understanding and say, oh my goodness, I know this stuff happened. It was horrible. It was bad. And I suffered as a result. Who wouldn't? But I now know that I don't have to carry all this with me because I'm much more than that. Mm. And there's so many stories like that.
Yeah.
One of the biggest realizations is for us has been that you cannot solve the problems of the mind by making the mind busier. Through, you cannot sort of intellectualize your way through to well-being. So, and that's where a lot of approaches go wrong. you know, with good intentions, you know, people propose this psychological treatment, another for that psychological approach. But many of those approaches take this idea of, oh, you can kind of think differently, or you can engineer your thoughts to kind of think more positively, or completely change the label of your thoughts in some way or the other. And I think that's taking a completely probably a very short-term view of things in terms of where transformation is ultimately going to come from. So when you hear stories like what Van said about Dr. Dave Pettit, seeing that in a person in his audience, you can begin to make sense that that's something, when the person's mind goes quiet, he's not engaging in his thoughts. That's something really comes, a wisdom comes from deep, in a non-mind space, if you like. And it's nothing to do with his thinking or thought. And that wisdom was something that was always sitting in him, always sitting in that. And we all have access to that. We all have access to that. But
how
we don't
can
believe
we access to that? Like, that's what's coming up in my mind. Like, how can we trigger that experience?
I guess, you know, when you try to, then it's like, you know, it's very, you know, it will be very illusionary. So when we try to do something, and we'll struggle with that. Whereas, you know, it's like trying to chase a butterfly and say, oh, how can I make the butterfly sit in my hands? Like, you keep chasing, and you know, we give up at some point. And when we are still, the butterfly lands on our hand. I think that's the metaphor I would use, because many times we try to solve our life's problems, like, you know, thinking and, you know, talking about it and brainstorming, and at some point we surrender and say, I give up, I really don't know when I can solve this, and at some point it just clears, you know, we are able to handle it, and, you know, something comes up, and I think when, you know, it's already there, like, say, how the more we say we need to chase it, it's like chasing the happiness. So you say, I don't want the suffering, so I want happiness instead. What if we knew that suffering and happiness are the two sides of the same coin, and we already are what we are looking for? And so that's what I would say to your question about how can we trigger that. Oh, because we can try that, because the ego will try, but then we will fail, because that's what happens.
Clever answer is not to stop trying. and that may sound quite dismissive for a lot of people, and say, okay, well, how does it happen? You know, you have to try to achieve something. But this is about less of doing, but more sitting in your own being.
Self-inquiry, isn't
and
it?
It's self-inquiry, exactly. And when it's about getting to that level of, once that sort of insight comes in, once that understanding leads you to that insight, then you will wake up one day and realize that, oh, I've been home all along, all this long. I've been in this place of happiness and joy and love. But I've been knocking on other doors and looking for those things elsewhere. And that's the core message, I suppose, we're trying to share. And it's about getting people off their heads, getting people off their minds. And if they have to do any activity, let that be an activity. Is it listening to music or going off on a walk or whatever, going to a conference or retreat? If that allows you to experience quietness of the mind and resting in your own being.
Yeah, those things can act like steps towards being, you know, because we are so conditioned to do. It's like hard to just drop it all and say, okay, I'm just going to be myself now. So things like going for a walk or yoga or meditation or mindfulness exercises may help to calm that doing down a bit.
Yeah.
I think there's really nothing wrong with any of those. Mm. People are doing those. And if you look at when people are talking about well-being, they're saying, do this, take a bubble bath, take like candles, do this. So there are great advice, but some people might be doing all those and still then the mind might not be quiet because they're trying to say, I'm doing this bubble bath, it's supposed to quiet my mind. How come it's not quietening? So I guess all those are activities and great activities. You know, please, by all means, do that. I guess what we're saying is that there's something deeper there that, you know, it's always like, How can I, you know, what's beyond this? What's beyond this? What can I notice, about me, perhaps, you know, like Sura said, who is the one suffering? Like, that might be a really interesting one. Or who am I? You know, am I my thoughts? And no, I'm not my thoughts. You know, am I this? Am I that? And I guess the thing is that all our thinking keeps shifting, our level of happiness in a day, joy, when we do yoga or something else, keeps shifting. But there's something that doesn't shift ever. There's something that's constant, despite all the noises, all the drama in the world and the chaos. There's something that just is. And no matter how much we do or not do, it's not going to make any changes to that isness. And that's where we are pointing people to. And people then can take their own, ways of trying to delve into that dimension. That's what I would say.
So I would like to touch another aspect of what you're doing, an important aspect, because you're doing two things at a time around this work. One is educating the patients, and the other one is sharing your insights and supporting other mental healthcare professionals. And you have a podcast for one, and you did a summit, I think, recently for the other. Can you please tell us, like, where our listeners, depending on who they are, can get more information about what you are doing and can join this new way of looking at mental well-being?
So let me put it this way. Maybe there are two kinds of audience. Maybe there's some audience who are really interested in well-being and they're thinking, I don't want to go on medication, or, you know, even if I go on medication, what well-being do I need to, how do I need to understand well-being, or what do I need to, get deeper into what these guys are talking about? So that's one audience. The other audience might be, I'm taking all these medications, I'm really still struggling. And I, want to come off the medication, but my doctors say, no, I have to be on for the rest of my life. And I don't believe it, or I am struggling with side effects, so I don't know what to do. So those are the two kinds of audience that actually we invited, or they got drawn into a mental Wealth Mastery Summit. Because some people were saying, we are harmed by medication, we're looking for alternatives. And some other people are already into well-being and maybe they have heard about innate health and they just wanted to explore. So it's the holistic view of how we can help. So if people just come to or just check us out, drsuranisuraj.com, we do share on our website what we are up to. But the main thing is that we are not saying people should or should not take medication. I think it's very important, like you said right in the beginning, it's like, are people well informed about the medications? You know, first, most importantly, informed consent. Before they even go to the doctor and start the medication, and they need to ask the doctors all this, because sometimes doctors do not give all the information they should be knowing before they even take medication. The other thing is, do they know of all the options that's available right now before they even go on the medication? Or if I have already been on medication and I need to come off it, what should I do? So we are catering to people, mainly professionals, to help people who are struggling, who are stuck. So they have a really good understanding of mental health, innate mental health. They also understand the current system of mental health, because if you don't understand how it works, then you can't help your client go through the system in a way that you won't be overwhelmed and you're given the right information. So that's what we are really passionate about. Number one, we are passionate about helping the helpers, like the therapists and coaches or mental health professionals who are somewhat, again, like us, dissatisfied with the current model and they say, we want to learn something different, or we don't know how to help people come off medication, all the people want us to. So how can we be part of a community? So there we have got that covered. We are helping those people. But other ones, like they might be professionals, they might not have anything to do with mental health, but they're struggling with stress and overwhelm. And they just want to be part of a community where we explore everything and explore innate health. Then also we have something for them called the Thriving Professional Community. So Suresh, do you want to add something?
Yeah, so we've got those two groups, and I'm also branching out into coaching myself.
Yay. On your own?
On my own. So that's a new thing because I've just recently released myself from my last day job, actually, in the NHS. So I've cut down my working hours at the moment just to for me to be able to do more of the work I want to do with individuals at the moment. So I've created a program for busy leaders and professionals who want to dive deep with me into even very deeper transformation. And so I'll be their guide for them to get to that sort of awareness and joy and happiness and productivity, creativity that they seek at this stage. So it's a 6-week program that I'm launching with live weekly one-on-one coaching calls with them and various other bits and bobs, and they will have access to some of the online courses we already have. There'll be a private Facebook group and so on and so forth. So yeah, all those information will be there on our website, as Rani said, drsraniswaraj.com.
It's the same website. There's no separate website.
It's the same website, yeah. There'll be links to all of those programs.
And as lay people or patients, we don't see, but actually there are a lot of mental health carers, doctors and nurses who suffer from stress themselves, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big issue, has been for quite a while, because helpers themselves are quite stressed. And last couple of years, we've seen the problem taking on a completely different shape, as well as with COVID-19 and how that's affected the world and the world of healthcare as well. And so we've seen that impacts, and people are under a lot of pressure, and they're constrained on resources, so you're having to do and offer more with limited resources, and that puts on a lot of people get overwhelmed and stressed, and for good reason. So that's there. So we really have to, as helpers, one has to really look after themselves, and to be able to really look after yourself well, you have to really know what's creating your own experiences. And so we do a lot of work with that community of therapists, coaches, and healthcare professionals who are keen to explore that deeper dimension, who are curious. And so they come seeking that for themselves first, so that they are able to then transform the lives of others, of course. And that's the right way to go about it.
Okay, final question. If this way of seeing patients, starting with seeing and then treating and healing, communicating, were to become a norm in the world of psychiatry, how do you imagine the industry being different or changing?
Well, that's a great question. I think there'll always be a section of this industry that will do what it's always doing, and maybe we need to make it okay. But there's also, like, many healthcare professions are waking up and saying, we can't just accept this as the norm. Let's wake ourselves up, and let's then bring people together. I'll just mention a tweet I saw recently where a very famous doctor who is into lifestyle medicine made this quote, like, lifestyle medicine, not lifelong medicine. I loved it. I tweeted about it as well. So, you know, rather than having lifelong medicine, how can we do lifestyle medicine? So that's one aspect, obviously. That's on a human level. we need to make changes. We need to look after body. We need to look after personal mind. So we need to do all the things that you said about yoga and woof. And because there's our lifestyle medicine and is there's evidence base for it for sure. So that's very, very exciting. More and more GPs are training in lifestyle medicine. And there are other branches like functional medicine, integrative psychiatry, you name it. So people are now branching out and saying, we can't just accept, you know, this very fixed, rigid model. This is like going to be obsolete at some stage. So there are lots of different paradigms coming in, so to speak, of in a holistic way of approaching psychiatry. And also, if we were to get people to really look within and go beyond the just surface of, I'm doing these changes to my lifestyle, or I need to change my thinking, or I need to take medication or therapy, to, you know, what's beyond all that. We can only imagine that it's the best we can ever have. And how I see it is that if one person heals, it's not just going to be one person. One person wakes up, you know, they have all this, you know, they have an enlightening experience, they have a deep insight, they made some changes to their lifestyle as a result. What, you know, they are also going to influence their family, their immediate family, like their loved ones. And they'll say, you know, mommy's different, daddy's different, what are they doing? So that's going to be different. So if we can imagine, like, you know, people just keep waking up, then they are also affecting other people. And so I think I'm hopeful that a lot of misinformation out there about mental health and about how antidepressants are the best thing, and they have no side effects, or, you know, it's easy to come off antidepressants, all of this misinformation will also like disappear, and people will have informed, you know, will be given informed consent before they are even given medication. So it might be needed, but they have to be, they are absolutely clear in their head that this is why they're taking it, how long they're going to take it for, and also the help they will get after they want to come off it. That's the healthcare I'm envisioning for the future, with more and more people waking up to things that we are doing. And it's promising, and we are excited about it.
Wouldn't it be a completely amazing world when we have convinced ourselves to move away from concepts and frameworks and labels to define the human condition, but to actually rest in the truth of our own being, truth of that deeper awareness. As helpers, we need to be that. We are that. As helpers, we need to be in that. We need to go get to that awareness ourselves, so that we can pass that on to who we are serving, our patients and our clients. And I think that'd be indeed a nice place to get to. And we are hopeful, Ani and I, that we are seeing that we get to see glimpses of that progress in the system, albeit slow, and sometimes we lose our patience, but it's progress nonetheless, and that gives us a lot of reason to be optimistic and to be hopeful for the future.
Right. Dear Suraj and Rani, both of you, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your wisdom and vision. Thank you.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for interviewing us, Ella.
Thank you.
And for everyone watching, we will link to Suraj's and Rani's website and other related social media websites. So please check out our website, and thank you for listening.